what do we aspire for when we brag about conquering space, but at the same time want to conquer and rule over others? Who are we when we are proud of going towards the stars but continue to create havoc on Earth? No other species on Earth except mankind treat their own the way we do. Until it was decided by the people that it was time for a change, blacks started to strike and take to the streets to try to bring about the more equal society.
We will be able to work together, to pray together, to struggle together, to go to jail together, to stand up for freedom together, knowing that we will be free one day. We'll be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last.
Ultimately, Dr. King was able to get the Civil Rights Act signed by the president. And around 50 years later, this would lead to having a black president in the White House. So, was King's dream achieved? Vondrett Myers, who went to the store near his home to buy a sandwich, but he would never make it back home as he was shot 8 times by police outside of the store. Police say he was carrying a gun. Eyewitnesses say he had a sandwich in his hand. No one was tried for his murder. Vondrett's name is added to the many others who have been recently shot by police. I wanted to talk to Vondrett's parents, but between police and demonstrators, it was very difficult to do.
They just killed him. To this day, the police still cannot articulate a reason why they stopped Vondrett and his friends down the street. There was no reason for them to stop them. They initiated, Jason Flannery initiated that stop and then went on to kill him and blame it on him. Vondrett was executed because he was down, unable to move when he was shot in the head. The police department has said that they don't see any need for charges to be issued. Of course, they're not going to say that. They're investigating themselves.
I believe that we will win.
But they trick us into believing I'm the solution. If you elect me, we'll all be free. It's a bunch of garbage. You know what I'm saying? I don't care. It's from the alderman, the president. And you know what people say? Well, once we get a black president, things are... Now, the highest office in the land, right? The president. When did he address the issues of race? I mean, without beating up on black men for not being fathers. And that's, when did he address it? Ferguson, when the whole world had to address it.
As violence and oppression continues against blacks, some Americans have mobilized to say they will not stand for this any longer. From Ferguson to Chicago, Los Angeles, New York, Baltimore, and beyond, Americans are demonstrating. They are blocking streets, having die-ins, and overall taking to the streets to try to bring what they call police terror to an end. Others have rallies and meetings trying to educate the masses as to the reality on the ground. At the University of Chicago, activists say they want the U.S. government to be charged with genocide for crimes that it has committed against black Americans.
American police kill a black person every 28 hours. American police kill a black person every 28 hours. While imprisoning and assassinating our civil rights warriors who fight against these same crimes. The state is responsible for torturing and displacing indigenous people with violent spiritual, physical, and sexual assault, along with poisoning all of our ecosystems. Rape is the second highest crime committed by police. 500 people tasered to death in the U.S. Over 12,000 human lives lost to police genocide. We implore this committee to seek redress for these extrajudicial, state-sanctioned executions, electrocutions, murders, and other crimes documented in our report. We charge torture. We charge genocide.
My brother and best friend was brutally battered and permanently damaged by the Chicago Police Department. The result of such damage left half of his face unrecognizable, his tongue barely attached to his mouth, 22 stitches, 2 facial fractures, bruised ribs, scrapes all over his body. I'm here to charge torture for my brother. We're here to charge torture, and we're here to charge genocide.
I had some police brutality problem for a while. They've been going on for a while, whereas they were extorting me for 25% of my money, and they were using, since I wasn't going for that, they were harassing me. They were raping me in my house, videotaping me.
And tell me how you're walking with a walker now.
I'm walking with a walker because my legs have been beat when I'm sleeping. I got more than 1,000 bruise marks on my butt. Body. Every time I try to put something on paper, I'll make a report. They beat me up in the house. They're breaking my house, beating my legs. They're cutting my hair. They are saying that this is my imagination. It's a complete system of destroying other people's life to try to make people slaves for them. I got pictures of it. I show the doctors. I told the FBI, the police, they laughed at me. And then I told them what they did in my house. They said I was crazy. It didn't happen. But you can look at my belly and see that it did happen.
This has become a familiar scene in the Black community. Here is another mother who has lost her child and shows me where her son was killed. Murder, poverty, and despair has become the norm. Another example of this despair is the singer and rapper of this documentary, Harvey Shaw, who lost his 17-year-old brother, was killed by police.
Okay, so right now, like I said, we're going through South St. Louis, head on the Cherokee area, on Cherokee right now, the State Street area, where you have pretty much is a blend of different races, but it's also on every single state street down here is also another set, another gang set. And you have a lot of Hispanics and African Americans over in this area down here. And we're about to South St. Louis, you know, after like 1 o'clock, I believe it's like 1 o'clock, they have a curfew. And that's for all the people over there, especially for young Black males, that if you out on foot, even if you're at the gas station, they calling them jump out boys, pull up in those SUVs or them vans. And if you out there, that's subject to arrest. And really what they looking for is just warrants. I mean, if you don't have no warrants, they probably gonna search you. If you got a cigarello, that's paraphernalia. Some reason they gonna have to incarcerate you.
Phone call from my daddy that was in 2002. I picked up the phone and it was something different in his tone that I can just hear. They got Stanley, I'm like, what you mean they got Stanley? Who got Stanley? Police, they killed him. And I just remember it felt like somebody just took my whole heart and just pushed it up my stomach and was like, what you gonna do about it? This is the life you know that you're living in. Now it hit your little brother. All I could see was his big old smile that he had on his face. Never was a negative person, always was smiling and laughing. Now he's gone off the face of the earth. That somebody willingly took the life of my brother who was law enforcement. Declared war so publicly, so intensely on the young black male across America. And it was so visible on how they let them just lay in the street. Like, we're gonna show you, we're gonna let you soak this in, young black man, that we are here to annihilate. We are here to destroy. A police officer is a 2014, go back in 1714, he was called an overseer. Now he's called an officer. One had a whip, now this one has a gun. The whip would just get you back into chains, and if you talk after that, you get hung. You get castrated. Now, you just dead. They don't even want you around because they figure you survived through all that torture and you still out here? We just gonna kill you now. That's the picture that's getting painted. This is not my system. It's not good for my system. This system is not good for anybody's system that's created or designed to have any type of love inside of them. This system is designed to, you either gonna get aboard the hate train or you gonna get annihilated. And they're making that very clear.
I don't have any fear of any reprisals from the government or anyone else. I do believe that there are those out there that are watching and maybe would take action, but I don't concern myself with them. I just concern myself with doing the work, you know, for this movement. My grandfather was asked the same question, whether he was fearful, and he said that he was probably a dead man already, but he said that he had absolutely no fear of anyone or anything, you know, other than Allah.
The history of blacks is filled with resistance groups which try to liberate themselves. One example of this is the Black Liberation Group MOVE. In 1985, this group based in Philadelphia, which was active in organizing its members, was surrounded by 600 federal agents and policemen and was bombed by the U.S. government, in which 11 people, including 5 kids, were killed and 66 houses destroyed.
Where governments lie, God does not lie. Where governments change, God does not change. And I'm through now. But let me leave you with one more thing. Governments fail. And the United States of America government, when it came to treating her citizens of Indian descent fairly, she failed. She put them on reservations. When it came to treating her citizens of Japanese descent fairly, she failed. She put them in internment prison camps. When it came to treating the citizens of African descent fairly, America failed. She put them in chains. The government put them on slave quarters, put them on auction blocks, put them in cotton fields, put them in inferior schools, put them in substandard housing, put them in scientific experiments, put them in the lowest paying jobs, put them outside the equal protection of the law, kept them out of their racist bastions of higher education, and locked them into positions of hopelessness and helplessness. The government gives them the drugs, builds bigger prisons, passes a three-strike law, and then wants us to sing God Bless America? No, no, no. Not God Bless America. God damn America. That's in the Bible for killing innocent people. God damn America for treating our citizens as less than human. God damn America, as long as she tries to act like she is God and she is supreme.
I was teaching in Cape Town. I was talking on this particular morning about the difference between Western concepts of personality formation and African concepts of personality formation. The Western I just mentioned, Camus, Cartesian, I think, therefore I am. I rebel, therefore I am. I did it my way. Africans say I am because we are. It's communal, not autonomous. If you see God as white, you see God as male. You see God as up there above hierarchically. You see God as choosing you above other people. Then you see other people hierarchically to be used as things not equal to you. Three-fifths of a man in the constitution of the country. And your theology determining your anthropology then determines your sociology, how you order your society. You can order your society so that blacks are non-persons. So that the Dred Scott for this project decisions make perfectly good sense. I know rights you have. I can put on a black robe and be a preacher on the day and a white robe at night. In fact, have my lynchings on Sunday. Civil disobedience, non-violent civil disobedience to bring about change, which is what? First Sunday this month, several black churches in this nation engaged in civil disobedience. What did they do? They disobeyed the law about the red lights in the street. They went up and blocked traffic, some of them powerfully, for 8 minutes. That's how long it took Eric to die. And then 8 minutes, they dispersed. They're making a statement, disobeying the law. You see the difference between that and staying on the sidewalk, walking down the sidewalk, obeying the police? Is it me or do you see the difference? This, the sit-ins, we broke the law. The law says you can't sit here. And black bodies say, yes, we can, and sat there. That's disobeying the law, all right? You walk on the sidewalk and stop at the red light. That's not disobeying the, that's a peaceful, mamby-pamby, wimpy way of trying to show solidarity.
The first thing that has to happen is the conscious raising of the people. When you're involved in your own fight for liberation and freedom, it's a liberating feeling. You want to do more and more and more and more. And I always say, oh, I'm too old, I can't do this. It's something that everybody can do, whether they're young or old. People that can't walk good, they can make phone calls and tell people about different means. You know, people think the media is independent. The media is to reflect the interests of the state against the interests of the people. Malcolm X talked about when you go on a demonstration and then you go home and look at it in TV, you say, wait, is that the same demo that I was at? You look at what's happening in Ferguson. You look at, I always look at Fox News, you know, for a laugh or two, you know, because it's a whole different story that you get than what actually happened.
I think that we should realize that whatever it is that attracts us to any of these great personalities or individuals, it's like a mirror reflection. It's something that is reflected within ourselves. So we should look within ourselves and decide what we'll do. You know, each man is like a grain of salt toward the building block of civilization. So we shouldn't focus on what everybody else is or isn't willing to do, but on what we're going to do.
You have no rights which a white man has to respect. Were the words spoken regarding the Dred Scott case, how far has the society come to changing that reality? How much are we willing to sacrifice? How much are we willing to give for freedom? Again, demonstrations are taking place. People are taking to the street, but will that be enough to bring the ultimate change to the U.S.? The change that will see everyone treated equally. The change which will see blacks and other minorities no longer threatened by police and the American legal system. That verdict is still out.
There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
If saving trillions of dollars and millions of lives isn't enough to end political bribery in America, what will it take? Says Tom Hartman, author, in an article published under the heading, How many billions in profit is it worth to kill 212,000 Americans a year? Stay tuned for more. Senator Bernie Sanders and Senator Lindsey Graham had a debate on Fox Nation. Sanders asked, In the United States, Lindsey, we spend twice as much per capita on health care compared to the people of any other country, while major countries like Canada, UK, Germany manage to supply health care to older people. Why is that? The simple answer is the same reason Americans have an ongoing climate crisis and a student loan crisis that Republicans refuse to let Congress address, the legal bribery of politicians like Lindsey Graham. How much money would it take to bribe you to help kill 212,000 Americans in a single year? What size incentive would cause you to assist in the theft of $543.6 billion? It's a serious question. These are real numbers. The bribery is real. The debts are real. The thefts from the American people, most extracted from individual families, are real. The real people, American lobbyists offering the bribes, and real people, American legislators taking the bribes to make choices that killed 212,000 Americans in 2020 while picking over $543 billion from American taxpayers' pockets. According to Open Secrets, the amount spent just last year bribing Congress to keep U.S. healthcare system in place was almost $750 million. In exchange, the health insurance industry took home $19 billion in profits last year. Hospitals took home over $70 billion in profits, and the pharmaceutical industry made similarly huge profits last year, at least $100 billion. And that was after each of these three industries that have a stake in keeping U.S. healthcare system as broken and dysfunctional as possible had handed out billions in compensation to their senior executives and board members, not to mention stockholder dividends. So the healthcare industry made out well. Its executives are buying third and fourth mansions in Swiss Alps. Its lobbies are enjoying their time. And the politicians it owns are becoming multimillionaires. In every other developed country in the world, the national healthcare system helps keep costs in line, be they hospital or pharmaceutical. Health insurance in other nations is a marginal business around the edges, used almost exclusively by the very wealthy to get private air ambulances and luxury suites in hospitals. Drugs cost as little as a tenth of what they do in the U.S., and everybody in other developed nations has health coverage. Last year, over 500,000 families were destroyed by bankruptcies caused by a family member getting sick. Every single one was in the United States of America. This is an unknown problem in every other developed nation on planet Earth. But how are Americans doing? A new peer-reviewed study published recently in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences lays out a damning picture of the damage caused by roughly $700 million a year the healthcare industry uses to bribe American legislators. We estimated, the study's authors say in the study's abstract, that a single-payer universal healthcare system would have saved about 212,000 lives in 2020 alone. We also calculated that $105.6 billion of medical expenses associated with COVID-19 hospitalization could have been averted by a single-payer universal healthcare system over the course of the pandemic. These economic benefits are, in addition to $438 billion expected to be saved by single-payer universal healthcare during a non-pandemic year. Since five corrupt Republicans on the Supreme Court legalized bribery of politicians in a shocking series of decisions with no parallel anywhere else in the developed world, Democrats have tried repeatedly to end this deadly ripoff. In April of 1976, the year of the Supreme Court's first decision legalizing bribery of politicians and only of politicians, presidential frontrunner Jimmy Carter proposed a national health insurance system. As president, he faced fierce resistance from paid-off politicians, most but not all Republicans, and ended up settling for small changes around the edges. In 1993, Bill Clinton tried again to extend health coverage to all Americans and rein in costs with a national system. He too failed to overcome opposition from the industry and their bribed politicians. Barack Obama campaigned on a single-payer universal system like Canada, but had to settle for the Affordable Care Act because of the $1,182,700,000 health insurance industry had given Senator Joe Lieberman, in addition to millions to virtually all the Republicans. Obamacare, particularly after five Republicans on the Supreme Court got it, its Medicaid expansion provision turned out to be a $1 trillion gift to the insurance and drug industries. The bribes are so extensive, so widespread, so lavish, that Biden hasn't yet even seriously brought up the topic of Medicare for All or something like it. The U.S. healthcare system let over 200,000 Americans die in 2020 just to preserve its profits. It handed part of those profits to politicians to keep the system in place. And somehow, those politicians sleep at night and can look themselves in the mirror. A national single-payer healthcare system would save Americans trillions of dollars and millions of lives every decade. It's opposed by every single elected Republican and a handful of Democrats. Every one of them undertake to keep things the way they are. If saving trillions of dollars and millions of lives isn't enough, end political bribery in America, what will it take?
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Turkey has targeted northern Iraq, killing several people and injuring a number of others. The strike hit the Sinjar Resisting Units, or YBS, a militia affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, in Iraq's northern province of Sinjar. Turkey regards the PKK as a terrorist outfit. According to security sources, the strike hit a municipal council building in Snani, a village near the border with Syria. Turkey regularly carries out airstrikes into northern Iraq and has sent commandos to support its offensives. Baghdad accuses Turkey of violating its sovereignty. Turkey has a long-running military campaign in northern Syria against Syrian Kurdish YPG militia. Ankara considers that group as a terrorist organization as well. Ankara is reportedly planning to expand its military operation in northern Syria. President Erdogan has told the parliament Ankara aims to resume its efforts to create a 30-kilometer safe zone along its border with Syria. He has also urged NATO member states to support his country's efforts to establish a safe zone on the border with Syria.
It is crazy to think that the Turks will be fighting American-sponsored Kurds, and there isn't anybody in the world community that can call them up on the hypocrisy and say, you are fighting amongst yourselves in a way that could end up in a world war.
Turkey has deployed forces in Syria in violation of the Arab country's territorial integrity. The Syrian Foreign Ministry called on the international community not to work with Erdogan on the lands of other countries to achieve goals that will have catastrophic effects on security, peace, and stability in the region and in the world. Russia also considers Turkey's possible military operation in Syria unwise as it could escalate and destabilize the situation. Iran also voiced concern about the planned operation, saying the move could complicate the situation even further. In Syria, Turkey conducted three military operations in 2016, 2018, and 2019 that specifically aimed to prevent the formation of politically autonomous regions along the Turkish border controlled by Kurdish-dominated YPG militants. A fourth operation in 2020 in the Idlib region did not specifically target PKK affiliates, but it was in line with Turkey's desire to maintain territorial control and create a buffer zone along the Turkish-Syrian border.
But it's a big problem. It shows Turkey up for what it is, and that Turkey is doing everything in the region purely for their own short-term benefit, and they are quite happy to fight the Kurds and crush the Kurds. And this completely conflicts with the Americans. Well, the Americans aren't really trying to help the Kurds, as they aren't ever really trying to help anyone apart from themselves. And their short-term allies, the Kurds, are going to end up fighting their other allies, the Turks.
Ankara-backed militants were deployed to northeastern Syria in October 2019 after Turkish military forces launched a long-threatened cross-border invasion in a declared attempt to push YPG fighters away from border areas. Turkey has played a major role in supporting terrorists in Syria ever since a major foreign-backed insurgency overtook the country more than 10 years ago. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and other senior officials have said the Damascus government will respond through all legitimate means available to the ongoing ground offensive by Turkish forces and allied Takfiri militants in the northern part of the war-battered Arab country.
Iran is expanding its diplomatic and economic ties with its neighbors and beyond. On Wednesday, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi hosted his Turkmen counterpart Serdar Berdimuhamedov in Saadabad Palace in northern Tehran. Iran and Turkmenistan signed a set of documents and memoranda of understanding to broaden bilateral cooperation in different fields. 9 MOUs were signed in the meeting to boost cooperation in various fields, including politics, economy, trade, transportation, investment, new technologies, environment, sports, energy, judiciary, education, research, and tourism. This is Berdimuhamedov's first visit to Iran as Turkmenistan's president. He traveled to Tehran in January as the special envoy of Turkmenistan's former president and held talks with Raisi. Iran and Turkmenistan have agreed to set up a major trade center that can facilitate ties between businesses in the two countries amid efforts to deepen economic relations between the two neighbors. The establishment of the Tehran-Ashgabat Trade Center was discussed on Tuesday during a meeting between Iranian Trade Minister Reza Fatemi Amin and Deputy Head of the Cabinet of Ministers of Turkmenistan, Batir Atayev. On Tuesday, Iran's president hosted visiting Pakistani Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari. During the meeting, Raisi hailed ties between Iran and Pakistan and said Tehran and Islamabad can expand their bilateral trade and business ties to benefit both nations.
I find this most recent flurry of diplomatic activity and state visits to Iran to be highly significant. What this signifies is that clearly Iran, far from being isolated on the world stage, is in fact extending its ties, bilateral ties, both regionally and as well ties to Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere.
And earlier in the week, Iran welcomed Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro and his high-level delegation. Iran and Venezuela have signed partnership agreements in the fields of science, technology, agriculture, oil and gas, petrochemicals, tourism, as well as culture. Raisi hailed the accord as an indication of the two countries' determination to expand bilateral ties despite U.S. and Western pressure. And the Venezuelan president, for his part, lauded the 20-year partnership agreement between Tehran and Caracas, saying the two sides will be able to expand bilateral relationship by consolidating their ties and drawing a clear vision in the next two decades.
As far as the outcome of these visits, this can only be positive for these nations, for most recently Pakistan, whose prime minister visited for the Turkmen president, and as well for President Maduro, those nations and national leadership that seeks to maintain sovereignty and independence, especially and particularly from American global economic and military hegemony, will greatly benefit their national economies as well as their populations.
And last month, Iran hosted Tajikistan's President Emomali Rahman. That visit also resulted in the signing of major deals between Tehran and Dushanbe. Since the inauguration of President Raisi's government, Tehran has stressed on the expansion of ties with regional as well as non-regional countries. Raisi's major achievement was his attendance at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Dushanbe, where Iran was formally accepted as a new member of the organization. Iran's accession to the SCO will be a major boost to the bloc's influence in the region.
I believe what we're seeing is the relatively exciting and promising, although challenging, beginnings of the complete break from the dollar-based global economic system. I say exciting and promising because this will definitely enable nations that seek to maintain their independence and sovereignty to break from the dollar-based global economic system. However, this is certainly not an easy task and one that comes without costs.
Mainly because Iran's massive transportation network can facilitate regional and international trade. Iran is also expected to benefit economically from the membership in the bloc. The Iranian Customs Office said that Iranian exports to SCO members had increased by 41% year-on-year in the 11 months to late February, reaching nearly $18.3 billion.
But ultimately, we can look forward to the development of actual systems and structures that will enable nations, independent sovereign nations such as Iran, Russia, China, Venezuela, potentially other nations in the region who want to get on board, Turkmenistan, Pakistan, which we were recently talking about, to move towards a system that is not reliant, for example, on SWIFT and that completely bypasses the dollar.
Earlier this year, Iran's president also visited Russia to expand bilateral ties. Tehran and Moscow reached agreements to expand their cooperation in the fields of industry, defense and aerospace sectors, as well as oil and energy. The burgeoning ties between Iran and other countries have foiled plots by the US and its allies to isolate Iran. They also show that sanctions and threats have failed to stop Iran's progress.
After some three decades of a fall in the global stockpile of nuclear weapons, the world seems to be on the brink of witnessing a reverse in the declining trend. The Stockholm International Peace Research Institute's yearly report states that online possessors of nuclear weapons, namely the United States, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, China, India, Pakistan, Israel, and the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, continue to modernize their nuclear arsenals. The arms watchdog, also known as CIPRI, says the total number of nuclear weapons declined slightly between January 2021 and January 2022. However, a senior associate with the think tank says there is evidence of change in where the world is headed and warned that this is a very worrying trend. The trend in nuclear weapons worldwide has been witnessing a declining trend for a long time. It is now lower than one-fifth of what it was within the arsenals of the nuclear powers at the top of the Cold War in the 1980s. And now, CIPRI's report comes at the height of mixed signals regarding nuclear diplomacy. Earlier this year, the five UN veto powers, including China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States, declared their intention to take action against the further spread of nuclear weapons. But the think tank asserted that all five countries had since further expanded or modernized their arsenals.
The United States has attempted to take control as a unipolar power, and it's been a calamity for around the world, actually, for so many countries in so many ways. And for the last two decades, they've been driving forward. They have abandoned the nuclear treaties that were hammered out over the last part of the 20th century.
CIPRI reports that Russia and the U.S. possess about 90% of all nuclear warheads in the world, while the watchdog says the number of nuclear warheads in both countries fell in 2021. It states that the decline was mainly due to dismantling of those which the military had already abandoned years ago. CIPRI says that out of the total number of global nuclear warheads, an estimated 3,732 were deployed with missiles and aircrafts, and around 2,000 were kept in a state of high readiness, nearly all of which belong to either Russia or the United States. The Russian military doctrine allows the battlefield use of nuclear weapons, and the Biden administration has discussed possible responses. But who is following the path of war more, risking the use of nuclear weapons?
The United States is definitely driving this process. They're driving NATO ever closer to Russia. And I think that when you say the U.S. and its allies, you have to realize that Russia has allies as well. And those alliances are being strengthened by the U.S. aggression that's happening right now. The U.S. aggression in the Middle East has driven Syria and some other country, and Turkey, actually, who are not getting along with each other, but they're both being driven more into Russia and China's orbit and out of the U.S. economic center. And now with NATO pressing up against the borders of Russia, I mean, it's truly a terrible thing to do, and not to acknowledge that anyone has interest except the United States. So, of course, Russia's going to defend their borders.
Meanwhile, as the West proceeds with its acts of aggression across the globe, it has also ramped up its rhetoric against Iran. This comes as one of the U.S.'s closest allies, Israel, which also possesses nuclear weapons, has made threats against the Islamic Republic. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett claimed that Tehran was drawing dangerously close to producing nuclear weapons. The accusation comes despite Tehran's strong rejection of producing or even considering nuclear weapons. Bennett also called on the global community to ramp up efforts against Tehran, saying Iran's nuclear program won't stop until stopped. The warmongering aspirations of the U.S. and its allies comes while the world seems to be faced with many other challenges. Relations across the globe seem to have deteriorated further at the time when humanity and the planet face an array of profound and pressing common challenges. And while such difficulties could only be addressed by international cooperation, many, including the U.S., seem to be more focused on aggressive policies. China and the U.S. are locked in a growing war of words over the self-ruled island of Taiwan, which Beijing considers as part of its territory. But now, amid simmering tensions between the superpowers, at the security summit in Singapore, Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin accused the Chinese military of provocative and destabilizing activities near Taiwan. During the same event, the Chinese defense minister hit back at the U.S., saying Beijing had no choice but to fight if attempts are made to separate Taiwan from China.
If anyone dares to secede Taiwan from China, we will not hesitate to fight. We will fight at all costs, and we definitely will fight to the very end. This is the only choice for China.
I think it was very clear the exchange that General Wei had with Secretary Austin was quite straightforward as far as we understand, and his speech was also, of course, very sharp. In terms of outlining what the Chinese were prepared to do if Taiwan would declare for independence. Now, both these people laid out their positions on this, but the question is still very unclear how far the United States is willing to go in trying to use Taiwan in their attempt to bring together the countries of Asia as a counter to China.
But China also struck a more pacifying tone, calling for a stable China-U.S. relationship. Wei stated that the China-U.S. relation is at a critical and crucial juncture. He added that Beijing believes a stable Sino-U.S. relation serves the interests of both countries and the rest of the world. The Chinese defense minister also noted that China had achieved impressive progress in the field of nuclear weapons. Wei, however, noted that Beijing will only use them for defending the nation, never starting a nuclear war, nor ever use nuclear weapons first. He pointed out that the ultimate purpose of China's nuclear arsenal is to prevent a nuclear war. The Chinese defense minister slammed Washington's new strategy, stating that it will lead to further tension between the two countries.
The reality we are witnessing is different to U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin's remarks on the Indo-Pacific strategy. The strategy is an attempt to build an exclusive small group in the name of a free and open Indo-Pacific to hijack countries in the region and target one specific country. It's a strategy to create confrontation to contain and encircle others.
Meanwhile, regional countries also seem to be unaligned with Washington's stance, especially in the light of China's direct investment in Pacific Island countries, which it views as important components of its Belt and Road Initiative.
The Chinese have had a very ambitious and very successful program with the Belt and Road Initiative, which has helped to fill the deficit in infrastructure in the Asia Pacific, and this is only beginning now. What the U.S. has to offer is a system of rules in which these countries must abide by, possibly in order to attain increased trade, but they're really not offering anything concrete other than being associated with the United States and a few other countries.
Washington has made no secret about its stance on China. But the new world order and financial order is taking shape already, and the U.S. is left behind. The U.S.'s use of the dollar as a weapon has pushed nations who have been targeted closer together. This includes energy-rich powerhouses like Iran, Russia, and Venezuela. Even Saudi Arabia is changing some of its oil sales to the yuan. Therefore, it now seems that the U.S. is on the losing side of the ongoing rivalry with China, especially considering what many believe to be its failure, both militarily and economically.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A congressional committee has heard former U.S. President Donald Trump pressured his Vice President Mike Pence to overturn the 2020 election, despite having been told repeatedly that doing so would be illegal. We are prepared for an article written jointly by Patricia Zengerler and Richard Cowan. The piece is titled U.S. House Panel Hears Trump Pressured Pence to Overturn His 2020 Election Defeat. Aides to Mike Pence told the Congressional Committee investigating the 6th of January 2021 protest march on the Capitol, when thousands of people marched against the certification of the November 2020 election, which placed Joe Biden in office as the current U.S. president. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pressured his vice president to overturn his 2020 election defeat. According to a Reuters news agency, members of the Democratic-led House of Representatives Select Committee said recently that Trump continued his pressure campaign despite being told repeatedly it was illegal to do so, as Mike Pence and lawmakers met to formally certify Joe Biden's victory. The 9-member Select Committee's public hearings, launched recently, intends to put up a case against Donald Trump that he was responsible for the 6th of January 2021 violence, starting with knowingly spreading lies around the election, seeking to overturn the election results, assembling the mob in the Capitol, and failing to act to stop the violence. The committee is trying to build a case that Trump's efforts to overturn his defeat amounted to illegal conduct, far beyond normal politics. Mike Pence has criticized Trump's earlier complaints about his handling of the 6th of January joint session, which, as a part of the regular legal process of validating presidential elections, was convened to certify the legitimacy of the Electoral College votes of the various states. Donald Trump has repeatedly denied wrongdoing while maintaining that he lost the election only because of widespread fraud that benefited the Democrat Joe Biden. Trump and his supporters denounced the 6th of January panel as a political witch hunt. Trump claimed that he won the 2020 presidential election and that there was massive voter fraud. The former president claimed that he ordered 10,000 National Guard troops to protect the Capitol building. The certification vote on 6th of January 2021 had become a focus for Donald Trump. On 6th of January 2021, Trump supporters occupied the U.S. Capitol while lawmakers were in the process of reviewing the certification of state electors, which indicated Joe Biden's victory. Some Trump supporters had hoped that this process could have resulted in some of the electors being disqualified, thus overturning the outcome of the presidential election. It is claimed by some that the demonstrators were infiltrated and incited by provocateurs from U.S. intelligence agencies who orchestrated the false flag operation in order to get rid of Donald Trump. Some among the crowd clashed with police officers and some made threats to beat up a number of Democratic lawmakers. Some also inflicted damage on parts of the Capitol building. Mark Short, who was Mike Pence's chief of staff, claimed in videotape testimony that Pence told Trump many times that he did not have the authority to stop the vote certification in Congress. Gregory Jacob, an attorney for Mike Pence, said the main proponent of that theory, attorney John Eastman, admitted in front of the president 2 days before the January 6 attack on the Capitol that his plan to have Mike Pence halt the procedure would violate the law. John Eastman had argued that Mike Pence could reject results from certain states if he thought they were illegitimate, giving Republicans in those states an opportunity to declare Donald Trump the victor despite the actual vote count. Advisors to Mike Pence told the committee that the idea had no basis in law. Former U.S. Appeals Court Judge J. Michael Luttig, an informal Mike Pence advisor, said it is breathtaking that these arguments even were conceived, let alone entertained by the President of the United States. Committee members and witnesses warned that Donald Trump, who is widely expected to run for president again in 2024, would not accept defeat no matter the actual outcome. Former U.S. Appeals Court Judge Michael Luttig said, "Today, almost 2 years after a fateful day in January of 2021, that still Donald Trump and his allies and supporters are a clear and present danger to American democracy. The committee showed several chilling clips of some of the thousands of Trump supporters who descended on the Capitol building, chanting for Mike Pence to be pulled out of the building or hanged. Trump tweeted at 24 minutes past 2 in the afternoon local time, while the protest was going on, that Mike Pence did not have the courage to stop the vote count. Sarah Matthews, a Trump White House staffer, said in a video testimony it felt like he was pouring gasoline on the fire by tweeting that. Donald Trump accused Mike Pence of having acted as an automatic conveyor belt for the old crow Mitch McConnell to get Biden